The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So we begin today with Parshas Vichye, which is the last Parsha of Bereishit. Vichye Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim shivasrei shana, and Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. Chapter 47, verse 28. So Yaakov lives in the land of Egypt 17 years, and the days of Yaakov's life, the days of Yaakov, the years of his life are 147 years. It's a very strange verse, right? Just the way it's constructed is a little difficult. First of all, like, what do I care how long Yaakov lived in Egypt? And the verse is very, I mean, generally, if they're going to tell me this is the last parsha of Yaakov, okay? He's coming to the end of his career. So, okay, fine, I understand they're going to tell me the amount of years he lived. But don't tell me the amount of years he lived. Tell me the amount of years he lived in Egypt. He lived in Egypt, but his days were, the years of his life were 147. Interesting. Yaakov lives in Egypt. That's like the climax of the Torah. Yaakov lives in Egypt. Let's think about it. The Torah starts off with the first man and woman. Where are they? In the Garden of Eden. And they get thrown out of the Garden of Eden. The entire history of mankind is exile, trying to get back to the garden, which is besides Woodstock, there's another kind of garden that we're trying to get back to. And trying to get back to the garden, and, well, you would assume there'd be some kind of connection between the last Parsha and the first Parsha of the Torah. And the interesting thing is, we know that Yaakov has the beauty of the first man. Yaakov fixes the sin of the first man in terms of himself. And yet, Yaakov, in the end of his life, finds himself in Egypt. Interesting kind of relationship, right? He's in Egypt, he's in exile, and yet he lives in Egypt. So the Midrash says Yaakov never had it so good in his life. His kids were around him, he had a lot of nachas, you know. He had a lot of happiness, he had complete happiness. In fact, the Midrash says over here, why is this Parsha Satum? Now, what does Satum mean? In the Torah, there's various ways of starting a paragraph. So whenever they start a new Parsha, generally there's at least 9 letters missing. There's a space of 9 letters. Within a Parsha itself, between paragraphs, you'll generally have something with 3 letters, a space of 3 letters that will separate paragraphs. But what's strange about this Parsha is there's only 1 letter separating it between the last one. So it's called Satum, blocked. Okay? So the Midrash says the reason why this is blocked is because suffering and troubles in Yaakov's life were finished and blocked out from this world. In other words, the greatest time of his life, apparently, was these last 17 years in the land of Egypt. And you say to yourself, well, how could Yaakov enjoy himself so much in the Galut? How could Yaakov so much enjoy himself in a condominium in Egypt with all his nachas Jewish kids when he knows that he should be in Eretz Yisrael? And that something's missing over here. And yet this is the happiest time in his life. 17 years, gematria tov, the numerical value of good. There's great years in his life. So Yaakov is having a phenomenal time in Egypt, yet Egypt for the Jewish people mystically, philosophically, is the depth of tumah, the depth of impurity. And yet Yaakov is able to live, and not only live, but there's a certain revitalization of the man, okay, in the land of Egypt. Now let's understand this. Basically, let's think about what kind of life Yaakov had, to really understand what it means to have a good life in Egypt. Yaakov had the hardest life that anyone could ever have imagined. Right? You think you might have had it hard? When you think about, we go back through history of Yaakov's life, think about it. He never had a tranquil time in his entire life. This is only these 17 years. In fact, from very birth, not even birth, from conception alone, we learned that he was already struggling with his brother. Right? He didn't even get out into this world he was already struggling with. But he was fighting with his brother about the firstborn. Right? And, we talked about it before. His mother would go past the place of idolatry. There was a struggle inside them. And the Talmud says that in the very womb of their mother, Yaakov and Esav were fighting over who would get this world and who would get the next world. Okay? So already in the mother's womb there was a fight. Then when the kid's being born, he's holding on to his brother's heel. And then for some strange reason they call him Yaakov, which is connected to this idea of heel. The word Yaakov means heel. Okay? Then he's got this tough brother and everyone thinks he's a great tzaddik and he's got to somehow get the birthright and he struggles to get the birthright. Then he goes in there and he steals the blessing and he feels guilty for much of his life. In fact, until today, you will see that he still has some kind of guilt that he's trying to deal with. All right? Then he runs away and he's a fugitive. His very brother's trying to kill him. His very brother's son finds him and he says, listen, take all my money because if I'm totally poor, then it'll be easy if I'm dead. He says, okay, I'll take all your money. So he's a pauper. Right? Then where does he go? He goes to the land of Lavan. And what does he do in Levon? He's victimized the whole time. The greatest rip-off artist in the world. This is a life. Then the woman that he loves the most, he's so happy, finally he's going to marry the woman he loves the most, wakes up in the morning, it's her sister. Okay, so he works another 7 years, finally marries hers, we have problems having children. Okay, so now there's a strife between the sisters, and this sister wants the husband and that, and there's this very strange marital triangle going on. His whole life, if you see that, the arguing between the wives and the strife for him, and it's unbelievable. Then he has these children. And you think, okay, finally got your children. Oh no, then the children are fighting. Okay? And the children are fighting, and then finally the kids decide they're going to take Yosef, which was so treasured to him, because this was the son of Rachel, right? Who in fact, by the way, dies on him. Poor fellow, while he's on the way. And it was such a tragic death that he wasn't able to take her. One of the reasons why we'll talk about it, he couldn't take her to Hebron and bury her Marat Machpelah. So poor Rachel is buried right there in Bethlehem and everyone visits her on Christmas. And what's she doing in Bethlehem? Right? Right? And so you can imagine the struggle, the pain, and one of the reasons he couldn't take her is he couldn't bear it. It was so tragic for him, and how could he leave the kids? He wanted to bury a Marat Machpelah, some explain, but he wasn't able to because how could he leave the kids? And unbelievable. And she dies. How does she die? Just when she's giving birth to her second child, which is like, what more tragic death can you think of a woman dying at the very moment she's giving birth? And then finally, okay, so he's got his sons, but it's certainly hard on him about his wife. What happens? His sons are fighting, there's a lot of tension, there's lack of peace, and the sons decide to sell off Yosef. Tell him that his son was killed. 22 years he mourned. Now we're told that a person mourns, or is supposed to mourn, for a little less than 12 months. And one of the reasons is that the heart forgets after 12 months. But Yaakov never forgot. So his whole life he was mourning. 22 years from the time that Yosef was sold to the time that he finally sees Yosef is 22 years. Imagine 22 years of your life and you're in mourning and you're in mourning. What kind of life is this? What kind of life did he live? Very, very hard. Very, very hard. When you think of it, you know what's so amazing? The Talmud says that he was the chosen of the forefathers. Give you a little sense of what chosenness could feel like. Struggled his whole life. Very painful, difficult life. And so, with that in mind, let's kind of turn back. Turn back. Chapter 47, verse 8. When in fact Yaakov gets down to Egypt, and he meets Pharaoh. So, Pharaoh says to Yaakov, how old are you? It's a kind of interesting thing. I mean, you know, you meet a person, the first thing he says, how old are you? You know, how are you, Yaakov? It's been a pleasure having your kid Yosef around. great kid, sweetheart, like him, you know, helped us out, you know, something a little more. The first thing he says to him, V'yomer, Paro, Yaakov, how old are you? And why did he say that? Because he was in absolute shock. He looked at this man, and he saw such age, so much age on Yaakov. Okay? And so he said, how old are you? You look so old. So Yaakov answers him, Yemei Shinei Migurai, the years of my sojourning is 130 years, ma'at v'ra'im, a little and very bad, are the days of the years of my life. And the days of the years of my life didn't meet up to the days of the years of the life of my forefathers in their sojourning. Now the Sephorna points out a beautiful thing. Paro asked Yaakov, what is the days of the years of your life? And he answered him, the days of the years of his sojourning. He said, listen, I've been wandering, schlepping, a stranger in strange land for 130 years, but to tell you the truth, the days of the years of my life, that's not life. I've been a stranger, a wanderer, tossed from here to there, no tranquility. But the days of the years of my life, little. And now I look old. And they were bad. Now the Gemara says, because Yaakov kvetched just a little bit with these words, which are exactly 33 words of kvetching, he lost 33 years of his life. Because Hashem says, what, you're kvetching? I mean, you got Yosef back. You got Dina back. I forgot to mention his daughter was raped. You know, another thing, beautiful experience in his life. He had a very hard life. A very, very hard life. Tremendous suffering. And yet, after all that, and he recognizes, now, Tov, 17 good years, I can retire. But where do you retire, Yaakov? And how could you feel good about it? He retires in Egypt. So let's go on. Retires in Egypt. So Galut, somehow, Galut, exile, still can be good. After all those years, still can be good for a man like Yaakov. Why? They'll tell you why. Because of what the Ramban says. The Ramban has an amazing piece over here. It warrants hearing the whole thing. I simply took the English Ramban to read it carefully, easily. I have already mentioned that Jacob's descent into Egypt alludes to our present exile at the hand of the fourth beast, which represents Rome. Now, you know, the entire Bereishit, the Rambam establishes another place that Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim, that what happens to the forefathers is a symbol of what's going to happen to the children. If you want to know Jewish history and what's going to be, really look through the book of Genesis, you'll see the secret of all of Jewish history. When Yaakov goes to exile, he plays out the exiles that the Jewish people would have to go through. Well, so this particular exile, as well as Avram went down to Egypt, but he came out with a lot of money, right? So all their entire lives mirror what will be in the future. So the Rambam establishes that this particular story about Yaakov going to Egypt tells us about our exile. We right now are in the exile of Rome. Not we, Hashem. We're in Eretz Yisrael. But those who are outside of Eretz Yisrael, and because all of Am Yisrael is not back here, we're still in the exile of Edom and Rome. It's called the fourth beast because in the prophecy of Daniel, he saw these four kingdoms and they had four symbols of beasts. All right? There are many parallels between our exile and what happens to Jacob. For it was Jacob's sons themselves who by the sale of their brother Joseph caused their going down. How did they go into exile? How did they go into exile? They went into exile because the brothers were fighting. And they sold out Yosef. Do you know how we got into this exile? It's one of the most frightening scenes. Frightening scenes. It was the descendants of Yehuda HaMakabi. Great tzaddik. Right? Who basically reinstituted the base of Mikdash in his struggle against Greece. Well, the Hashmonaim became the kings of Israel. And many years later, 68 BCE, what happens? Shalomis, who was the queen, who was a descendant, she has these two sons, a guy named Hyrcanus and a guy named Aristobulus. Okay? And she decided before she died, she said, who should be the king? Who should take over? Well, they started to fight. No, you don't take over. Yes, of course. And it what became a civil war. You know, we don't think that Jews ever had civil wars. If you don't read Jewish history, you think, it was a civil war. Such a terrible war. Some people followed Hyrcanus and his claim, no, I should be. And some people followed Strobus and they said, no, I should be. Right? Well, what happened was, they decided, ingenious, they decided that they would ask the advice of Pompey. Since Pompey of Rome was capturing Asia and was a very powerful position, decided that this Gentile will be able to determine and to settle the dispute between these two Jewish brothers. Okay? So you think Pompey was an idiot? Pompey decided. He saw which one of the brothers was the weakest. He said he should be the king. Well, you think that helped? Didn't help at all. It continued to be a fight. And so what happened? Right? One of the brothers asked Pompey to help him in the fight. So who let the Romans into Jerusalem during the civil war? The Jews. Hyrcanus' people opened the gates of Jerusalem to let Pompey in to destroy Aristobulus. And what did he destroy? He destroyed Jerusalem and he took it over. And that's what happened. That's what happened. For it was Jacob's sons themselves who, by the sale of their brother Joseph, caused their going down there. It was the brothers. You look at what's going on here. Why are we in exile? It's not anybody but ourselves that put us here. Jacob, moreover, went there on account of the famine, thinking to find relief with his sons in the house of his friends. His son's friend, for Paro loved Joseph and considered him a son. And therefore there were some Jews that went willingly. They thought, oh, it'll be good in Rome, it'll be fine, it'll be better outside. They said, oh, they'll take care of us, it'll be wonderful. It was their hope to ascend from there as soon as the famine would cease. And so too, why did Yaakov go in there and why was he happy? Because he knew that this exile was only a stopover. He had the vision to understand that I'm not here for very long. I'm just here until the famine's over. That's why he had a good time. He had a totally good time, and it was just for having that good time, because he had absolutely no intention to stay. However, just as they said, to sojourn in the land, so that's when they came down, they said to Pharaoh, we're only here because we have a famine in the land. Meaning, as soon as it's over, we're out of here. But then they did not come up. That was the mistake. They should have left. And they were able to leave. But instead, the exile prolonged itself upon Jacob, and he died there. So yes, Jacob was happy there because he had every intention to get out as soon as possible for 17 years. But then he got sick. And then he realized, my gosh, I'm going to die here. And his bones ascended from there accompanied by all the elders and courtiers of Pharaoh. So who took the bones of Yaakov out of Egypt to Israel? Right? Who put Yaakov in Israel? The courtiers and the elders of Pharaoh, who instituted severe lamentation for him. They cried for him. Listen to this. Our relationship with our brothers Rome and Edom is similar. Now he's talking about his time. He's talking about our times. The dynamics going on there is happening in our times. Why? We ourselves have caused our falling into their clutches, as they made a covenant with the Romans, and Agrippa the last king during the Second Temple fled to them for help. Right? We go fleeing too. The Gentiles to the exile for help. It was due to the famine that Jerusalem was captured by the Romans. If it wouldn't be for the famine, and you know why there was a famine? There was so much food in Jerusalem that they could have lasted this siege for years. But you know what happened to that food? Right? The zealots burnt it because they wanted to force the Jews to fight the Romans. It was the Jews. That's what's so frightening. And the exile has exceedingly prolonged itself over us. with its end, unlike the other exiles, being unknown. So, just like his exile was unknown, he didn't know, when are you going to get out? So too, ours is prolonged. We put ourselves in there, right? And we've been prolonged. We are in it as the dead. In exile, we're as dead. Who say, our bones are dried up, we are completely cut off. To be in exile, the Ramban says, and he's talking about himself. The Ramban's writing about himself, we're dead. We're dead. But in the end, you know what will happen in the end, after we're dead, after all our bones in the exile, but in the end they will bring us up from all the nations, they will bring us up to the land of Israel, as an offering to the Eternal. What's that supposed to mean? What do you mean they will bring us up as an Eternal? Now the Ramban doesn't know what's going to happen, but we know it happened. They brought up the Jewish people to the land of Israel as an offering. What do you think? What do you think was going on when everyone decided after the Second World War, right, after the First World War? What do you think that the Gentile world thought about the Jews? Why give us the land of Israel? It's an offering to the Eternal. That's what the land of Israel is. Oh, we know what we did to the Jews. Right? Whether we did it directly to them or we just didn't save them, you're still partners in crimes. We'll bring their bones up as an offering to God. And Eretz Yisrael, and giving the state of Israel to the Jews, is the world's offering to God. It's a peace offering. It's an atonement offering. And that's what the prophet says. And this, the Ramban is quoting, you should look at it over there, it's the end of Isaiah 66:20. It's the end of Isaiah, which talks about this. And they will be in deep sorrow as they will behold our glory. And what will happen? On one hand, they've got a guilt offering, and giving the Jews Eretz Yisrael is their guilt offering for what they did to the Jews. But on the other hand, they will be in deep sorrow as they will behold our glory. Isn't that what's happening now? You think, come on, leave us alone. We just have this little piece of land. Haven't we been tossed for 2,000 years? Haven't we gone through enough torment? So on one hand, we're going to give it to you. And then, after they gave it to us, oh, we don't know if we can give it to the Jews, the Arabs, you know, they're not happy about it. It's an amazing thing. And then it says, and they will be in deep sorrow as they behold our glory. Once they saw the Jews be really revitalized, they saw the Jews come alive once again in Eretz Yisrael, they were willing to bring our bones back. Okay, the refugees, you know, let them go back there. It's our peace offering, it's our guilt offering. But once they saw, behold their glory, and we will see the vengeance of the Eternal in the end. May He arise us that we may live in His presence. This is what the Ramban says. So, what? Our whole story over here. Yaakov is an individual, but Yaakov plays out history on an individual level. And yes, he lived in the exile. And yes, we can live in the exile. And there have been times for the Jewish people where the Jews lived in the exile. And the one that I think the most is the exile of America. Because the exile of America is probably one of the nicest exiles the Jews have ever had. One of the nicest exiles the Jews have ever had. And so one hand, Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim v'yichyi. You see a revitalization of the Jewish people in America. Yes, there is that possibility. But why? Because what does Yaakov understand? We'll see what Yaakov understands. He understands we should only be here until the famine. But it's prolonging. It's prolonging. And chas v'shalom, Yaakov leaves Egypt only in his bones. And so, v'yi yimei Yaakov shnei chayav, and it was the years of Yaakov, 147 years. 17 good years. Very hard life. But he had a good time. And it's okay, he can enjoy it. As long as he maintains the vision. But what happened? V'ikrivu yimei Yisrael lamut. Now all of a sudden there's a change. It was talking about Yaakov, and then it starts talking about Yisrael. And it says very specifically, and the days of Israel came close to death. So the Midrash points out that Yaakov never died. His days died. That's what exactly says. V'ikrimu yimei Yisrael lamut. It doesn't say, and Yisrael came close to dying. It was time for him to die. But his days came close to dying. Yaakov is the individual. Right? But Yisrael is that national side of Yaakov. And that's where Yaakov has to say, I'm having a good time as an individual in Egypt. Well, that's very nice for me, Yaakov, as an individual. But for me, as Yisrael, the founder, the father of Am Yisrael, he started to see his days dying. Right? Now the individual in Galut has to ask themselves, yes, I'm having a tremendous time here in Galut. And don't we deserve it after all those years of trouble? But then you start to see the Yemei Yisrael mut. Right? Maybe as an individual, so you'll die. Everyone's going to die. So what's the difference? I die in America. I die in, you know, I die. Everyone's going to die somewhere. What's the difference? But then he realized the difference is maybe Yaakov can die in exile. But Yisrael can't. And so if Yaakov dies in Yisrael, if Yaakov dies in Egypt, that means he brought closer the death of the days, the future of Yisrael. And so what happened? Vikru lifno Yosef. So he calls his son Yosef. He realized, calls in his young son Yosef. Yomer lo, he says to him, says, if I have found favor in your eyes, I got favor in your eyes. Do me a favor. This is your son. You got to do me a favor. Yaakov feels a little uncomfortable. We'll see why in a second. V'yomer lo, im na matzati chen b'enecha, if I found favor in your eyes, put your hand under my thigh and do for me kindness and truth. Right? Take hold of the Brit, the covenant, the future of the Jewish people. That's what I'm talking about. Me as Yaakov, I understand you might not care about taking me out of Egypt. You might not understand it. But me as Yisrael. Me as Yisrael. I as Yisrael. This is a question of Brit. This is a question of covenant. This is a question of the promise and fulfilling the promise. Yes, I'm having a good time here, but you know what? I prolonged it and look what's happening. I'm starting to die in the exile. It's one thing to have a good time, but when you start to see the dying in the exile. So he says, do chesed ve'emet. Do kindness and truth. Now why is it called kindness and truth? So it's very famous. The most truthful kindness is to bury someone. Why is the most truthful? It's the most honest form of kindness you can ever demonstrate to a person. Because you do not expect any repayment from that person. Because they're dead. It's a hard thing, right? When you do a nice thing for a person, you have in the back of your mind, well, but then, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch my back, it'll be fine, you know. How do you know, right? How do you know that your chesed is totally shlishma? Totally for the sake of the chesed. Well, there's one chesed that's totally, it's burying the dead. There's nothing you can get back from the dead. Right? They won't repay you. And so he says, do totally chesed ve'emet for me. Al na tigverveni b'mitzrayim, please. This is what I'm asking. It's the first thing that's on his mind. Don't bury me here. Don't bury me in the exile. Now, isn't that amazing? Yaakov was living in the exile. But when he got closer to his death, he said, you know what? I don't want to be caught dead in this place. That's when it hits you. That's when it hits you. No, I don't want to be caught dead in this place. Get me out of here. Get me out of here. Yes, okay, you know, get me out of here. And he wants it now. V'shachavti im avotai, and I will rest with my fathers, and you will take me out of Egypt, and you will bury me in their burial. And he said, I will do as you say. This is a very heavy, right? Yaakov is obviously very nervous. He's so nervous that he's asking him to swear, v'yomi hishbali, I want you to swear that you won't leave me here. And he took an oath. And Yaakov bowed down to the head of his bed. Very strange. You know what? What's happened to the Jews in the exile? What blew me away when I was traveling is not only have Jews resigned themselves to living in the exile, they're already planning their death in exile. There's such an important quality to being buried in the land of Israel. Buried in the land of Israel. So the Midrash in this place says a story about Rebbe and Rebbe Eliezer. And they were walking near the gate of Tiberias. and they saw a coffin being delivered from Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, to land of Israel to be buried. So Rebbe looked and said, what? Now he comes to Israel? Now he comes to Israel? What's the point? Right? And so he brings in a pasuk, right? He attributes to this scene that he sees an amazing pasuk. He says, ye have made my heritage an abomination during your lifetime, he adds. You didn't want to be here during your lifetime. And defiled my land in your death. Right? I mean, now you come here dead. Well, we know that death is tumat, impurity. So during your lifetime, you made my land an abomination. You didn't want to be here. And now that you die, oh, now you want to be here. Right? So this is, the Midrash says it right in this place. So Rav Eliezer answers him and says, no. He says, yet since he is buried in Israel, God will forgive him. As it says in Deuteronomy 32, verse 43, his land atones for his people. So therefore, it's a great mitzvah to be buried in Eretz Israel. And to be able to bury one's deceased in Eretz Israel. It's just the land itself has a quality of forgiveness. Now, am I to understand that that's why Yaakov wants to be buried there? Is Yaakov still feeling a little uncomfortable about his life? I'm sure he had such a struggling life. I'm sure he wondered, well, why did I go through all this? Maybe. There's a number of reasons why he didn't want to be buried in Chutz La'aretz. Another reason is, well, the Midrash says, Yosef says to him, but you know, why do you want to be buried? Why is it so important? So he said, because I want to be there for Mashiach. When Mashiach comes, I want to be the first one there to greet him. He says, okay, fine. The Gemara teaches, we all know that Judaism believes in the revival of the dead. You know, it's a very difficult idea. What's the revival of the dead? There is a natural phenomenon in our world that reflects the revival of the dead. That's a caterpillar. Because a caterpillar sheds its skin to find the butterfly within. Little Donovan. And what happens is, from our perspective, the caterpillar is going into a coffin, he's dead. If you were to cut it open, which I hope you won't, if you cut it open, so you would say, dead. But you don't really, he's not dead. It's only the beginning of a new life. So too, Judaism believes when a person dies, they're not dead. It's like you put a seed in the ground, so if you watch it, growth means decay. And so it's dying. Looks like it's dying. No, it's not dying. It's growing. And so Jews believe that there is a revival of death, and death is not the end. In fact, it's a beginning, a new beginning. But what happens? Where does Tchias HaMetim happen? Where does the revival of death happen? In Eretz Yisrael. So what about all those righteous Jews that are buried in New York? Right? California? Australia, wherever. What about those righteous Jews? So the Gemara says something very strange. I can't say I understand it, but I can certainly repeat it. That God will dig these tunnels, right? And their bones will roll until they get to Eretz Yisrael. So he also said, Dad, you'll be here. Right? You're a tzaddik, no problem. No. You'll take the express train, the underground, right? The subway, to Eretz Israel anyways, you'll be here. Yaakov says, yeah, I know I'll be here, but I don't want any more suffering. I had enough suffering in my life. I don't want any more suffering, even my death. I just get me to Eretz Israel fast. That's one reason also he wanted to be in Eretz Israel. Another reason why he wanted to be buried in Eretz Israel, he said, because I know that if you leave me here, they'll make me into an idol. Because the Egyptians basically idolized Yaakov. Right? They saw his power. They saw his stature. And so if he dies there, they'll make him into an idol. And if they make him into an idol, you'll never be able to get him out of there. And there's another reason why he wanted to be buried in Eretz Israel. One of the commentaries explained. Because he doesn't want to be responsible for any Jew ever going to visit him in Chutz La'aretz. It's a powerful thing. He said, I don't want my sons, my children, to ever have to come out of Israel to pay respects to me. Right? Yaakov is a visionary. He is a visionary. That's what's so amazing about the man. What keeps him going? What keeps us going? It's the visions. It's the prophecies. We should have been gone a long time ago. How do we keep going? We had such a tough life. Yaakov had the vision. Yaakov had the vision. So the Midrash says, why is this Parsha Satum, as we were talking before? We mentioned that there's only one letter space, unlike other places. Right? Because when Yaakov died, that's when the children went into servitude. Because Yaakov is the eyes. When Yaakov's vision went dim, when the vision of Am Yisrael went dim, right? As long as you have the vision, you can enjoy Galut, as long as you understand that until the famine's over and you get back there fast. But why do people stay? The famine's over. Why are we still in exile? Because the vision's gone. Right? The vision's gone. So Yaakov understands there's something he's got to give his children. He's got to give them the vision. So the Midrash also says, why is this Parsha Satum blocked only with this one letter? Because in this Parsha, in fact, Yaakov so much wanted to give his children the vision, he wanted to reveal to them the end of days. And when he called his children in, he said, let me reveal to you, Ketzer Yamim, let me reveal to you the end of days. And then he doesn't reveal it. Why? You can't give your kids too much vision. Why? Yaakov was going to basically tell them everything that's going to happen. All of history. But then if you tell them everything's going to happen, they're not going to do anything. I mean, if I know 100% sure the Jews are coming back to Eretz Israel, so I'll wait. When God wants us to come back to Eretz Israel, right? He'll bring us back to Israel. He'll just let us know when. In the meantime, we can enjoy these 17 years. You know, why not? Why not? Enjoy it. I remember I was living in Queens. It was unbelievable. It was tremendous. There was glatt kosher goulash, glatt kosher Chinese, glatt kosher pizza, Baskin Robbins is kosher. I mean, we had everything. But that's nothing. That's okay. That's physical. Excuse me. I'm sorry. But spiritually, there was this mikveh that was for free. Right? And it was this beautiful mikveh. The guys and I would get into the car, zoom over to the mikveh in the mornings, right? Diving board, just joking. Get into the mikveh. Then they have these showers with massage nozzles. And you walk in there and there's a little towel, a little piece of ivory soap. I mean, it was gewalt, right? Right? It's gewalt. It's not just the physicalness. There's this tremendous amount of spirituality going on over here. It's great. It's great. And I remember a friend of mine was speaking to a woman in California, a very religious woman, and she's talking about how tremendous her community was and how wonderful it's going. It's just great. So he looked at her and said, you know, it sounds like you're really happy here. She said, yeah. It sounds like you're really, really happy here. She said, yeah. He said, but you know, it sounds like you're really happy here. So she looked at him with a bit of an embarrassed look, and she says, you know what? I kind of hope and pray that when Mashiach comes, he'll let us stay. Lost our vision. Lost our vision. Well, so Yaakov wants to give the vision over. He said, I've got to give the children the vision. But he wanted so much to give them the vision, he was going to lay out all the history for them. Well, if you lay out all the history for them, that too could be, you know, counterproductive. Well, so if history's going to happen, history's going to happen, fine. Right? Oh, she's going to come, it's going to... No, Yaakov, Hashem says no. You give over the vision and you tell them, I don't even want to be dead in this place. Right? And that's my message to you. I had 17 good years, but then I realized I was just one day too long. You never know when that one day too long is. There's a very famous Talmud where a rabbi was on his way to come to Eretz Israel. And so he had it all worked out. He had his ticket and everything. He was going to the boat. And as he was getting to the boat, you know what happened? The boat left. So you know what he did? He jumped. Took a leap to get onto this boat. So this Gentile fellow sees him, looks at him and says, you guys are so impulsive. You Jews are so impulsive. God comes up to you, offers you a Torah, and you say, Naaseh v'nishma. you say we will do and then we'll listen. I mean, couldn't you check it out first? Why you gotta be so, you know, so fast with it, you know? What's your finger on the trigger for all the time? Why don't you guys lay out, like, you know, relax, and, you know, and think about it. The Torah sounds like a nice idea. We'll read it. We'll see if we like it. We'll give it a review. We'll accept it. Huh? He says, you guys are pizzazz. Right? Yeah, pizzazz, you know? You know, so impulsive, y'all. And now, look what you do. You could have killed yourself. What are you doing? Jumping. So, oh, you get another boat. Right. So he looked at him and says, get another boat. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't even make it to Eretz Israel. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't even make it to the land of Israel. You think I'm going to take a chance of even one moment? It might have been just that moment I had that chance. And Yaakov saw that the days of Israel were coming to its end. Yeah, I as an individual, Yaakov, yeah, sure, fine, I can stay here in the Galut. But what about I as Yisrael? I as the founding and the father of Jews, of the people, as a link in the chain of Am Yisrael, what's going to be with them? I got to give them the vision. Well, okay, it's too late. I won't take them back. But I'm going to make them swear. You swear you don't leave me here. You have to bury me in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so Vayomer said to him, swear, and he took an oath. Well, so what happens, V'yachre Advarim Eilu, chapter 48, and it was after these things. He bowed down to the bed because he was so thankful that his children were complete. When Yosef took an oath that I will take you personally, I, Yosef, Abba, no, I will personally make sure. Now you have to remember who Yosef is. He's functionally the king of Egypt, right? Yosef, he wants Yosef to swear. Why? Because Yosef is the success story of Galut. He is the most successful exiled Jew you can ever imagine. You know why he's so successful? Not only because of financially he's doing so well, but he's a from Jew. You know? That was so tremendous. So he wants Dafka Yosef. It's got to be Yosef who demonstrates that all the other Jews here, even though I, Yosef, am such a success over here, and I could even deal with it, and I could still be true to my Torah. Well, I could be true to my Torah, but I got to be true to the vision. And so he swears to him that he will do it, and he bows down to the head of the bed. So the Midrash says that he thanked God. Right? He thanked God that his children were complete. And he knew his children was complete when he saw Yosef take that oath and say, Dad, I won't do it. Because Yosef, as we learned once before, is the fixed Esav. Yosef has got everything Esav had going for him in terms of really knowing how to organize the resources of this world, right? And yet, he used it for God. He used it to support Torah. He used it to support Yaakov. And he showed his total commitment to his father, that I will continue the vision and I will bring you back. That's what we learned the other day. We learned that when Yaakov was going down there, he was a little nervous. And God said, don't worry, Yosef will close your eyes. Right? So one of the other understandings of don't worry, Yosef will be the one that will close your eyes and he will continue the vision. He'll take care of your eyes. Right? Who will take care of the eyes of Yaakov? That's the frightening thing. A lot of Jews keep Torah, but the vision, what's the ultimate vision? You gotta get in touch with it. Alright, so what happens is, V'yichareh Dvarim Eilu was after these things. So the Gemara, Talmud Midrash says, after what things? Right? After what things? And was told to Yosef, behold, your father is sick. The Gemara points out that this is the first place in the Torah that anyone was sick. Especially sick before they died. So Talmud points out that Yaakov prayed to God, please God have compassion upon me and may I be sick before I die. Right, you hear this? Please God have compassion upon me and may I be sick before I die. And so Hashem granted him that. And Yaakov, according to the Talmud, is responsible for people in this world. He brought this phenomenon in the world. Because before that, that's not what used to happen. You know what used to happen? People would sneeze and die. Right? That's how you used to die in the olden days. You wouldn't get sick and then die. You wouldn't get weak and kind of deteriorate and then die. Right? What happened is the person just, you know, they're fine. Everything's fine. How's it going? Right? Having a good time and then, oh, excuse me. And that's it. Gone. That's why when a person sneezes, the Midrash says that you should actually say, La Briyut, you should say something. You should be thankful to God that you're alive. Because when a person sneezes, they could have died at that moment. Right? Because that's the way people used to die. But now Yaakov prayed and says, no, please, don't let me die in a sneeze. Because if you let me die in a sneeze, there won't be time. It's such an important time with the kids, and they know I'm getting sick, and it's getting old. Right? The sad thing is, people get in touch with what's going on after people die. Right? When in fact, this whole period was to get in touch with what's going on. Exchange those moments. Fix those wounds, forgive, repair, and have the chance to tell over to the children the vision. Don't forget the vision. Don't forget the vision. So it was after these things, Yaakov prayed to Hashem that he be sick. And so Yosef was told, your father's sick. So he took his two sons with him, Menashe and Ephraim. And was told to Yaakov, saying, behold, your son Yosef is on his way towards you. So Yaakov, it says, it was told to Yaakov, your sons are coming. And then in this very verse 2, it says, V'yitchazek Yisrael. And Yisrael strengthened himself and sat on his bed. And what's going on? Is it Yaakov or is it Yisrael? So the question is, Yaakov is sick. And Yosef is told. And it says in verse 2, and Yaakov was told that Yosef is coming towards him. And so then it says, and Yisrael strengthened himself on his bed. So in one verse, Yaakov changes into Yisrael. So Yaakov is sick as an individual. But when his son comes, he realizes he's got to strengthen up. Right? This is not a time to say, oh yes, I'm feeling sick. Oh, I'm feeling so terrible. Oh, could you get me a glass of tea? He said, no, no, no. He said, as Yisrael, I've got to strengthen myself. And I've got to deliver this vision. So he strengthens up Yom Yaakov Yosef. So Yaakov tells Yosef a little history. He said, the God that appeared to me in Luz in the land of Canaan blessed me and said to me, I will make you fruitful and multiply, and I will give to you the Kahal Amim. I will give to you a congregation of nations, and I will give to you the land, this land, to your seed after you, an eternal. And now, your two sons that have been born to you in the land of Egypt, until I got there, are unto me, Ephraim and Menashe, like Reuven and Shimon. This is a very interesting scene. Yaakov decides that the two sons of Yosef will be like his own sons. Now remember, all the children of Yaakov have children. He's got grandchildren. But in terms of the 12 tribes, you don't really have a tribe called Yosef. You have the tribe of Menashe. You have the tribe of Ephraim. Why? Because of this. Right? Because of this. Yaakov decides that when Hashem blessed him, right, that I will make you into Kahal Amim, he already had Binyamin when this happened. So he said, I didn't have any more children. But God blessed me and said that he would give to me Kahal Amim. So it must be that one of the children of my children will be considered as if they're my children. So who are they? Who could they be? Who amongst my children are as if born to me like my own son? Obviously the children of Yosef. Why? Because he hadn't seen Yosef in 22 years. Didn't know anything about him. Thought he was dead. So of course, when he re-meets with Yosef, it's like Yosef is born into his life again. And when Yosef is born into his life again, it's with his two children. So he met Yosef, not as an individual one, but he met Yosef as a three. So he said, oh, that must be what it is. Not seeing these children being born and going through, and then all of a sudden, boom, Yosef with these two children. That's an experience of birth. Oh, okay. It's clear to me. That's what God meant. Right? That's what God meant. So he says, and all those that are born after these two kids, they'll be your kids. But they're not considered the tribes. All right. And you know that when I was on my way from Padan Aram, Rachel died. Right? And even though it was a short way to Ephrata, which is close, and I could have brought her to a civilized area, and I could have gone to Hebron, I didn't do that, I buried her on the way. Why does he bring that up? Why does he bring that up? Because this is disturbing him. Right? He feels a little uncomfortable. I know, Yosef, here I ask you to swear, right? And I want you to take me, and I want you to bury me. So why didn't I do it for your mother? Why didn't I do it for your mother? Right? She explains, Rashi explains, because I had a prophecy at that moment, and I was told that your mother has to be buried here because of the exiles. I had vision. This parsha is full of all these prophetic things coming out of Yaakov's mouth. Nowhere else in Torah you find this with Yaakov. But all of a sudden, Yaakov seeing the descendants of the descendants of the descendants, right? We have such clear vision, unfortunately, just before we die. Right? Everyone thinks, you know, just before you die, you see your whole past. According to this, just before he died, he saw the whole future. And he recognized he had to give the future over to the children. We have this sad mistake to think, that parents think, I have to tell the Jews about their past. Right? So the sad thing about Jewish education today is it's all based on the past. The children know the future. The children know the future. I'm embarrassed to say that when I was in yeshiva, we rarely learned any prophets. Tell me about the future. Children want to know about the future. He understood it. So he said, listen, I know how you're feeling and you're wondering why I left her in the middle over there. Because I saw the future. Because he knew there'd be an exile. There's a famous, famous saying and teaching that when she saw the children going out of Israel, her spirit came out of the grave and prayed, God, bring them back. And her merit, because she was praying, so I saw the future. So when Yosef sees his son, Yosef, the sons of Yosef, he says, who are these? Now, this doesn't make any sense. He just talked about how these two sons are going to be his own tribes. He just told them over, I'm going to give this over to you and make them, and I know how you feel about what you think I did to your mother, but I did it because of the future, and I had a vision, and I want to give this vision over. However, then he brings in his sons, and he looks at them, who are they? Is Yaakov going, Chas v'Shalom, senile? He doesn't know who they are. Well, so one simple understanding is, as the verse soon says, he started to go blind. Okay? Interesting, right? He started to go blind. His eyes are going. Yosef is taking over the eyes. He has vision, but vision beyond the physical. He's going blind. So he saw these images. And he said, who are these people? Right? Some other commentaries say that they came, and Yaakov looked at him, and he had this moment where he looked at him and said, gosh, these kids look Egyptian. That's the amazing thing about Ephraim and Manasseh. They are the two tribes that were born in Egypt, raised in Egypt. They are the exiled Jew. Can you give them the vision? Someone who was in Israel, you understand, right? But can you give over the vision of someone who was born and raised in the exile? So he looked at them, and he said, they didn't have Jewish garb, they didn't have sort of big Jewish haircuts, they looked very Egyptian. He said, who are they, my son? Who really are they inside? And Rashi brings down that he had another vision. He saw that coming out of their children was Yerivam v'Achav, coming out of Ephraim. And Yahu coming out of Menashe. And these were some very evil, very destructive Jews to the Jewish people, to Eretz Israel. So he had this, again, this insight. And so he looked at him, wanted to bless them, but all of a sudden he lost and said, how can I bless them when I see what's going to be? So that's why it says in verse 9 that Yosef says to his father, they are my sons that God has given me bezeh. So Rashi brings down the midrash, he shows them, listen, kosher kids, shows them the shtar, he shows them the engagement, he shows them the marital contract. And Yosef, according to your old tradition, at that moment prayed, right, for compassion. And so Yaakov got the energy back again. He said, okay, even though I see that in the future, it's okay. We can see even beyond that. All right. So he says, well, bring them to me. And now we have an amazing parable scene. You can't help but see what's going on over here. The eyes of Yisrael become heavy from age, and he wasn't able to see. And so he brought them close, and he kissed them, and he hugged them. What does this scene remind you of? Yitzchak. Hey, it's all coming back. Yaakov was standing in front of his father Yitzchak, and Yitzchak said, "Who are you, my son?" Now he's saying to his own grandchildren, "Who are you, my son?" And now he has lost his eyesight, and he says, "Bring them close, and I'll kiss them." V'yom Yisrael El Yosef, you know, your face, I never would have imagined. I would have seen, and here I see. God has let me see your children. Tremendous. So there's a tremendous experience he's having. Tremendous nachas. And so Yosef takes his children, brings them to Yaakov, and he sets it up like this. Verse 13. Yosef takes the two. He puts Ephraim to his right, which is the left of Yisrael. So, okay, you have to understand, Yosef standing there. Yaakov standing here, or sitting here. And he puts Ephraim to Yosef's right, which is Yaakov's left, right? Because if someone's facing you, it's the opposite. Then he takes Menashe to his left, which will be Israel's right. Okay? Now, in Judaism, the right hand is always more, the more important hand, so to speak, than the left hand. There's a certain energy to the right hand. So he sets it up, you know, okay, bless them. So he's about to bless them, and he puts his hands on them. And Yosef says, okay, I'll set him up. Right, the oldest will be on his right, and the youngest will be on his left. What does he do? Right? So Yisrael goes like this. He just simply changes his hand. And he puts his right hand on the youngest, and his left hand on the oldest. Strange switch. What does he remind you of? We know what it reminds us of. The same thing happened over there. Yaakov was the youngest. Esav was the oldest. Right? And somehow, the youngest gets, so to speak, the birthright blessing or the blessing of the firstborn, even though he's not the firstborn. What's going on over here? So it's an amazing verse over here. Verse 14. Sikel et yadav ki Menashe b'chor. Well, Sikel is like he moved, but Sikel means he understood with his hands, from the word Seichel. In other words, he was blind, he put his hands, he doesn't see them very well, and then his hands understood. His hands understood. And he just naturally moved them. And so, he blessed Yosef, and then he says a very strange thing in verse 16. He says, "And may the angel that redeemed me, or redeems me from all bad, bless these children." Now, what's the angel that blessed, that redeemed them from all bad? When we just learned that when Paro saw him, he said, "How old are you? You look so old." He says, "My life has been very few, and those few days that really were alive, right? They were bad." So now, why is he saying, this angel who redeems me from bad? Heard a beautiful shot from Yaakov Pupka. At this moment, Yaakov is having a cathartic experience. His whole life he dealt with, what would have happened if Esav would have gone in there? What would have happened if my father didn't mistakenly bless me? And now he knows what would have happened. It would never have happened, because the hands understand. Yaakov had this experience which he couldn't have known until this moment. At this moment he realized that had nothing to do with anything. Yitzchak's hands understood where they should go, because God was directing him. And only when he had that experience himself, where he just naturally was moved to make that switch, he realized that the switch would have happened anyways. That the hands of Yitzchak understood, and at that moment the angel redeemed him. His whole life was fixed in that very moment. In your last moment, your entire life could be fixed. Right? Your entire life could be fixed. At this moment, he had such a cathartic experience where he understood what could have been, what would have been. And so, this is basically the amazing thing. He then blesses in verse 20. He blesses, Yosef says to him, Father, you're making a mistake. He says, no, I understand. And that's when he experienced what it means to have blessing come through. That's when he experienced this tremendous, mysterious interfacing of human choice and destiny. I read a beautiful teaching from Rav Soloveitchik. You know, most people think that the future is defined by the past, but not so for Jews, right? The past is defined by the future. And Rav Soloveitchik says that whereby most people understand history as this unfolding from the past, it's the past that's kind of pushing the future forward, not for the Jews. For the Jews, the future is like a magnet, and it draws Jewish future forward. It draws the past forward. And that's the amazing thing. Yaakov at this point realized that the future defines the past. The past does not define the future. And he understood this with the children. He understood that Ephraim, why did he decide to make Ephraim, to give Ephraim this greater blessing? Because he saw in the future Joshua would come out of him and Joshua would take over Eretz Israel. He understood that the firstborn is not something that's based on the past. Hey, you were born first, right? But rather the firstborn is who chooses to functionally be the firstborn, who chooses to be the visionary, who chooses to go forward. And that was his catharsis. He realized that to be the firstborn in Judaism has nothing to do with your past. It has to do with your future. And so he looked at which boy has the best future, right? Because now's the time to understand that the present is defined by the future you choose. And so he blesses them. Becha yivarech Yisrael, through you Israel will be blessed, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and Menashe. And he put Ephraim before Menashe. Every Friday night you should bless your children. You bless your girls to be like Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Right? And then you bless your children, your sons to be like Ephraim and Menashe. Why them? From Yitzchak Yaakov. Why them? Why Ephraim? This is where we learn this from. Ephraim and Menashe. So some of the explanations are, why? You should be like Ephraim and Menashe. Because even though Ephraim was given over this firstborn quality, and he was the youngest, there was never a fight between Ephraim and Menashe. They kept harmony. They were fixated. Brotherhood has been a problem throughout the entire Torah. It starts off with the fight of Cain and Hevel, Yaakov and Esav. Difficult, right? Well, so there was a tremendous nachat. There was a tremendous pleasure when Yaakov realized that not only was it right to put the youngest first and the hands no, and the human choice is interfaced with the divine plan no matter what, but he also saw that there would be peace even after that. And that was a very cathartic experience also. And there's nothing more greater than being able to bless your children. Please, I bless you to be like Ephraim and Menashe. That even if your younger brother somehow is the Ephraim and you're the Menashe, right? That you should have that kind of peace. As well as I bless you like Ephraim and Menashe, that you should be a true Jew even though you were born in the exile, and even though you were raised in exile, but you'll have the vision. And you'll produce a Yeshua. You'll produce a Joshua that will continue the future, the vision going on. As well as I bless you like Ephraim and Asher, putting Ephraim first, because Menashe is first, because that's where he was born based on the past. But Ephraim's first, because that's who he chose to become and who his children choose to become in the future. And therefore, put your future before your past. Let your future lead your past. And have that vision. And so this is the beautiful teaching of Yaakov. Yaakov had vision. If anyone had a tough life, it's Yaakov. And so what kept Yaakov going? He had a vision. Right? He had a vision. And then he had that restful period of 17 years. But then he started to realize, hey, what happened to the vision? Me as Yaakov, fine. But myself as Yisrael, what's going to be? So you have to learn. We have to get in touch with, so what's our future? We're having a good time now. We had a great time in the past, or we had a tough time in the past. But the entire past, in one moment, can be fixed. And there can be such, and there will be a cathartic experience for all of Am Yisrael. And that redemption, in that moment we will see the entire past will be redefined by the future. And this is the famous understanding of suffering in the world. How do you understand suffering? So one of the parables is a fool, so to speak, walks in the garment district of Manhattan. Not because it's Manhattan. But he's walking in the garment district of Manhattan, and he sees this tailor take this beautiful cloth and he begins to cut it. The fool never saw a thing like that. He walks in there, he says, what are you doing? Why are you destroying this? And he says, I'm not destroying it. He says, sure you're destroying this. It was something complete. It was something beautiful. You're destroying it. Couldn't communicate it to him. The next day he walks in, he sees in the window a beautiful suit. He says, what a beautiful piece of creation. So the tailor said to him, don't you understand? What you saw yesterday looked like destruction. Now you see today was, in fact, a tremendous creation. You can't define the past without seeing the future, because it's the future that's drawing the Jewish people. And that's what we have to concern ourselves today, right? We've had a brilliant past, right? Jews are very proud of their past. And Jews talk about their past. And we've got so many beautiful memorials to the past, and so many different Holocaust memorials that have been set up, right? But you know what we're doing? We're remembering the past, and we forgot our future. And you know where the future is? The future is our children. The future is our children. And that's what's so frightening. You know, they're putting up millions of dollars to erect memorials of the Holocaust all over the world, right? But when it comes to Jewish education, to the future, to give over the vision to our children, what's going to be?
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.